This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Salut tous mes belles gays et mes beaux les os. C'est Matthew Mitchum et vous écoutez à Joy 94.9.
Hello and welcome to Been There, Done That on Joy 94.9. Hello, Phil.
Hello, we're on a reduced budget this week.
We certainly are. That's why I was sort of stuck for words for a half second there. Our usual occupier of that chair is missing.
Young Gordon is in South Australia.
And I hope he's enjoying himself and his activities.
With his friend.
How polite you are. With,
well, he's... They're not roommates.
Oh, no.
So they're
no.
just friends.
Oh, yeah. Have rumours been being spread, do you think?
Oh, no, they're not rumours. Gordon would be first to tell you.
That is part of what we'll be talking today about on Been There, Done That. Because our show is a history program and we're highlighting the activities of some of the icons in the gay world. Bicons, dicons, people who don't want to come out, people who are already out, people who we didn't realise were heroes in our eyes until after they'd gone and someone opened the closet door. Or other things like that. On today's show, we'll be talking about Idaho, or Idahot, or Idahobbit.
They keep adding letters. It'll be like GLBTIQ.
Exactly.
Etc.
Mark Bingham will be talking about Raymond Burr and Liberace. A few birthday girls around. Cher, Miriam Margolyes, and a couple of other characters, including Ted Allen. Let's start off, though, with Idaho Day, 17th of May this year.
What's the International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia, and Biphobia? Well, it was conceived in 2004, which is really quite recent if you think about it, because the problem's been around for a while. And essentially, it's trying to get the community to wake up and think.
And when you talk about the community, you're talking about the wider community, the general
the
community.
The actual people who live out there.
Out there.
Out there.
That mystical, mysterious place.
The ones who don't or wouldn't think twice about the problems that the gay community has.
Oh, it's not
because
their
they,
world.
They're not aware of it. In many cases, not aware that they are actually homophobic, in cases I know of. And a day like this is really aimed at those people, and I hope it's focused well at these people, to make them think, well, you know, the world is bigger than my backyard, and there are different people out there.
And I think this probably extends to lots of topics or ideas or concepts or even activities that the rest of the world performs.
And that's in our society.
Yeah.
And then we've got some of these, well, call them African countries.
Yes.
Where it's actually quite dangerous to be homosexual.
Oh, yeah.
Life-threatening. So those countries need the education. Here we're looking for compassion. Overseas, we're looking for, hello, look at what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, these are human rights we're talking about. And yeah, it's just, it's a wake-up call, and it needs as much support as it can get.
So on May the 17th here in Australia, we're alerting our own community, our wider Australian community, to the fact that we do exist, that homophobia, fear of the unknown, exists in lots of places, and we're here to try and educate them and dismiss those fears and to offer a bit of respect and sort of be sorry for perhaps the behaviour that they've already been doing.
I notice the wording, I use the word educate, but yes. I guess the politically correct one is to raise awareness. Because when I'm saying smarten up people, get educated, I'm not necessarily being entirely complimentary.
Funny about that.
That's right. There might be, you know, there's often some sharpness in my words.
Oh, yes.
You may not have noticed that.
Oh, yes, I've been on the end of it a couple of times. But one person who... received some acknowledgement of his bravery and care for fellow man, irrespective of what his own prejudices might have been, was Mark Bingham, who was on one of the planes that went down on that fateful day, 9/11.
9/11. He was on Flight 93. Which was the final hijacked plane.
It didn't go anywhere near the New York Towers.
No, it was, they suspect, and of course we don't know what the hijackers were thinking, was actually aimed towards Washington.
Washington, so, which is upstate?
Washington, D.C., it's below New York City.
Yeah.
But still on the East Coast.
Right.
So he literally could have gone everywhere or anywhere. I don't know how these people navigated because they weren't pilots and they turned off all the equipment on the plane. So they must have.
And you're
have
talking
had
about the hijackers.
The hijackers, anyway. Well, we're not talking about the hijackers. We're talking about Mr. Bingham. So he and some of his fellow passengers were talking to people on the ground through their sky phones and discovered what was happening in New York, and that must have been the worst possible feeling in the world to be in the air knowing planes were being hijacked. They also would have realized that their plane turned around because it was heading for the West Coast, and all of a sudden now it's heading back to the East Coast.
Where they took off from.
So they obviously had enough information to realize that they had been hijacked, and they also had the information of what the hijackers had done with the other planes. It's only one conclusion they could reach, fortunately.
Yeah.
Which cost their own lives, but didn't cost anybody else's life, and that was to bring the plane down.
Yeah, well, Mark Bingham and fellow passengers Todd, Tom and Jeremy stormed the cockpit and overpowered the hijackers. But in the process, though, plane did crash and all were lost.
Well, they knew that, though. They knew they had to get the plane out of the sky.
Out of the sky, yeah.
And that's, I guess, the definition of bravery is to know you're going to die and save other people's lives, and to actually go through with it.
And after his death, Mark Bingham was posthumously awarded the Arthur Ashe Courage Award in 2002. And then, after that, rugby came into the deal. What was that all about?
Well, there's International Gay Rugby World Cup, which is not my area of expertise in any level.
Me either.
But they named their, I guess, premiership trophy the Bingham Cup.
Yeah, but Mark Bingham was already involved in a New York City rugby team, the Gotham Knights, and he was their hero as much as anything before the event. And what they've done now is combined the bravery of bringing the plane down with the support of the rugby teams, and there is now the Rugby Gay World Cup, known better as the Bingham Cup. And it's contested every 2 years, and recently the Sydney Convicts team have won the championship 3 times, and they'll be in there, obviously, next time round to defend their position.
And they obviously spend a lot of time naming their teams.
Yes.
So New York being Gotham is just a little bit Batman-ish, and the Sydney Convicts, well, that's just cheesy.
Rascal. Let's have a bit of music, because we have Pussycat Dolls, and they say they don't need a man.
Well, they can speak for themselves.
Joy 94.9 in Melbourne. Joy.org.au for the world.
You're with Phil and Chris. Been there, done that. Joy 94.9. Thanks for being with us.
While we be here and do this.
Well, that's right. While other people are in Adelaide doing things, we won't say anything about them.
Unspoken things.
That's true.
But hello to Gordon if you're listening.
We're talking about Mark Bingham today because he had a birthday on the 22nd of May and died on September the 11th, better known as 9/11. In this little bracket, we're going to be talking about Raymond Burr. Who is he, one might ask? He was on TV, and his role on the TV was as a respectable lawyer, and everybody actually looked up to him, and he was quite profound in his legal knowledge, as per the script, and that was his only reputation in the world, in the bigger world. He was an extra in a lot of films and things like this, and he didn't have much of a profile there. But he was a sturdy, no-nonsense type.
Very solid build, and a very deep voice, which I won't attempt to mimic.
And therefore, he was very suited in his TV role as a lawyer to carrying off a very serious actor. And he would spend days and days remembering all the lines from the legal action that was occurring in the courtrooms. And it was basically nonstop. He would record for a week to get a one-hour show.
They were very well-produced shows. And this is Ironside and Perry Mason.
Well, his other two shows, yes. Because they had to be factually accurate. So therefore, the facts and the way information was being presented was really controlled by the legalese that was being used. Falsehoods couldn't be presented in the script, you know, when he was cross-examining witnesses and the accused and things like this.
It's a bit like today's show, Law and Order.
That's right.
Which starts every show by saying, you know, all characters and events in this are fictional.
That's right.
Any similarities between the living is purely coincidental.
That started out in 1956, wasn't it? Around about that, when Perry Mason first came to TV.
I think it started in 57 and ran till 1966, which is very early days of American television.
And so they were setting a standard, they were setting an ideal of how court cases could be presented on TV, when in fact it wasn't really actually happening. It was a fictional event.
Yeah, in fact, I think Perry Mason, time like 56, 57, would have been one of the few shows that was actually recorded and then played back.
Oh, of
course. Because so much of television was live.
Of course, we've got to remember that technology had that part in it.
Because what was it, telecine, I think was the technology, which essentially turned a camera into a screen for a movie to be projected on. So this would have been, I'd say, one of the first shows actually produced that way. And also, actually, I'm not sure, because it was the Lucy show, which came up with the concept of multiple cameras.
Oh, right.
So this could have been a single camera production. Much in the way that movies were made.
Yeah. But once a second camera was introduced, you could get the lead character, Perry Mason, delivering his line, and then you'd see the jury sitting there and see the expressions on their face.
And they'd all be shot separately.
Yeah, and then pieced together. That was an interesting way of doing it. Well, and NBC...
CBS produced the Perry Mason series.
And then the country... Network, NBC, ran another one called Ironside, in which he played Robert T. Ironside, the San Francisco chief of detectives. I nearly said detectives.
Well.
But he was wounded by a sniper during an attempt on his life and was left invalid in a wheelchair. So he was actually trapped in the chair as the detective in the Ironside series.
Little bit ironic to be called Ironside with a bit of iron or a bit of lead in your side. Another, I guess, a production note on the Ironside show is that it was presented on NBC, but it was produced by Universal Pictures.
Ah.
And that's a much more modern way of doing things.
Yeah.
And again, the Lucy show was another example where Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz actually produced that show and sold it to networks. Whereas previously the network just did everything. It's much like we had here with our TV shows, like Matlock Police would be made by Channel 10, or made actually by Crawford's for Channel 10. So the rise of the production company in this era.
Now, why is he, Raymond Burr, controversial? Well, the fact is that whilst he was portraying this rather butch and masculine person on character on TV, his private life was totally different.
Well, he had a partner for, well, most of his life. Really.
Well, interesting enough, this has started out because when he was doing his concentrated learning of lines and shooting the TV show, he didn't actually leave. He found it convenient not to leave the TV lot, and he had a little bungalow set up, and he found he needed a little house helper, and one of those people just happened to befriend him and became lifelong friends.
Well, they met in 1960. And Mr. Burr died in 1993.
Yes.
So that's quite a relationship. And he did...
And it was tolerated.
Well, it was... He had a cover story that in his earlier days he'd had a wife and son who were both killed in some manner. And the way he covered that backstory was saying, I don't talk about it.
Yeah.
Which today would just raise flags.
Exactly.
Well, of course you don't want to talk about it.
No. Even his co-actors didn't really realise that there was this other side to the character. He was so deep into the closet and deep into containing his private life that it took a fair while before it came out.
Yeah, I guess because he played such, for want of a better word, straight character, I could certainly understand his thinking that coming out as a gay man would jeopardise his career just head on.
Oh, definitely.
Because it's contrary to what he presents himself as.
I wonder how many total episodes that he did for his whole career there. It would have been quite some hundreds. And I reckon, as you say, that if his reputation was tarnished in any way, he would have been in the poorhouse quick time.
And the networks would have been rather unhappy too.
Oh, yeah.
If he's making money, they're making more.
But he was a well-known philanthropist. He gave enormous sums of money, including salaries from the Perry Mason movies, to charity. And he was also known for sharing his wealth with friends. He sponsored 26 foster children through the Foster Parents Plan, or Save the Children Fund. He gave money to the School of Law in Sacramento with some of the actual scripts of the Perry Mason series. And he actually was all-around good guy.
And why wouldn't he be?
Exactly.
If he's gay at heart, he's a good guy.
Stay tuned, because coming up after Lily Allen with Smile, we'll be talking about Liberace and his backstories as well.
Well, he wasn't gay either. He said so. We'll talk about it later.
We'll talk about that later.
I really like this guy, but my boss is really homophobic, but I don't want to out myself by speaking up.
I think I want kids, but my girlfriend doesn't.
I don't feel like I'm supposed to.
I think my sister is a boy. Can you help with that stuff?
My partner just died.
I'm new here, and I really need some information and support.
How can I meet people who are like me? I'm confused. I'm not sure if I'm gay or straight.
I like wearing women's clothes.
I just don't have sex. Like, I want it.
I don't want to be labelled.
Can I run something by you? I want to ask my partner to marry me.
Switchboard, partners in QLife Australia.
Call 1800 184 527.
Joy 94.9.
You're with Phil and Chris. Been there, done that. Joy 94.9. Thanks for your company on this show where we're discussing some icons and bicons and dicons. We've been talking about Mark Bingham and Raymond Burr. Now we're going to talk about Liberace, a whole different kettle of fish. Who was he, Phil?
He was an entertainer.
How polite of you to say so.
Well, he entertained lots of little old ladies.
Well, they weren't little old ladies. Society was quite different back when Liberace was around in, well, what would you say, in about the 30s and 40s and 50s. But when did he go onto TV? Early career was, well, he was a participant in 1937 before World War II in a classical music competition, and he won that. And then towards the end of the war, he moved away from straight classical performance and reinvented himself to featuring pop with a bit of classics. And then TV came along, and what happened there was that he had moved himself into another area entirely where there was more showmanship. In fact, rather than just sitting at a piano and playing and people listening, he started dressing up, let's call it that way, being a little flamboyant. It didn't seem to worry the people who loved his music, because he had the banter in between the songs. And they go for the banter as much as for anything.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the fox furs spread into be total furry capes. There was, his trademark ended up being, there was a candelabra on the gold grand piano. And there was lots of gold flashing, it appeared, from his teeth, although I don't think they were actually gold teeth or anything like that. But, you know, he was just sparkly, sparkly, sparkly. He was, in modern parlance, over the top. But
he's over the top plus 10%.
Yes. But he was really there for the married women who could look on him as a son. And he was a high achiever. He was very good at the piano. He wasn't all that crash hot, apparently, with singing. And his costumery would have entertained them as well.
Yeah, he was I only knew him from his TV show, which was a variety show, and he'd have his, I guess, monologue, and he'd have his characters from his life that he would talk about, like his brother George, and it was basically, I guess, his shtick. He played a very camp character, and that's how he presented himself on air, and for some reason expected us to all think that he was this perfectly straight man off air. And there were frequent outings, shall we say, in the press, which he defended in the law courts.
That's a bit strange, isn't it?
It's the exact opposite of Raymond Burr, who made up a straight biography, essentially, and then wouldn't talk about it.
Yeah.
Living a nice little gay life in the background. When you've got Liberace being as camp as a row of tents in front of the camera.
Yeah.
And denying it all. That's behind the camera.
Well, the good little short expression for both of them was that they were hiding in plain sight. But Liberace was hiding in a persona that was quite acceptable for that day and age, of being flamboyant. I wouldn't say he was the Adam Lambert of the period, because Adam is actually a pop person younger age group than the mothers that Liberace was aiming for.
And Adam, well, he was outed after American Idol, but he wasn't exactly in the closet.
No.
He just wasn't wearing a T-shirt saying, I'm gay. I remember watching Adam Lambert, and we won't get too far off Liberace, but watching him in the final few episodes of that season of American Idol, and he had his fingernails painted black.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's just his rock persona. See, Liberace was pretty talented, fairly good pianist, and Adam Lambert's voice really spoke for his character, and all his on-stage things were over the top, not gay, but just that role rock god type persona. And when he confirmed that he was gay, it wasn't a shock. In much the way that if only Liberace had come out and said, well, as a matter of fact, I am gay, the whole world would have said, duh.
Yeah.
Like, well, we know.
That's right. I mean, there's lots of pop stars at the moment who you could pin a gay label onto, and I'm not going to mention names, but they could deny it, or they could admit it, and it wouldn't hurt their careers one bit. And so in some ways, I suppose it's good that society's moved on from the days around Liberace or around Raymond Burr, where people had to hide their sexuality.
Yeah, well, let's see, the American society in Liberace's life, or that time frame, was not necessarily homophobic, but, well, phobia is the word, because the network would have been terrified if he'd come out.
Yeah.
I don't think it would have affected him personally at all, except maybe his income would be affected, but TV was squeaky clean. So I guess being gay would tarnish that image.
Yeah, well, round about 1975, Liberace ended up having a live-in lover of 5 years. He started out being his chauffeur, and the person by the name of Scott Thorson sued him for $113 million for palimony after he was let go by Liberace. This is during the period when Liberace was denying his homosexuality. And so, therefore, there was this court case and the palimony settlement. But after Liberace's death, Thorson stated that, he wrote a story, the biography of Liberace, the expose. And that was a little bit bit revealing in lots of ways, and became the basis of a film that was around a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, Behind the Candelabra, the true story of Liberace. Matt Damon was in the film. Michael Douglas played the role of Liberace, and it was a candid, touching and funny portrait of the gay relationship, and in fact, apparently not all that far from the truth. It wasn't dressed up to be extravagantly over the top, even though Liberace himself was. The story was over the top already.
But the film wasn't shocking because, it was, 26 years after Liberace had died from an AIDS-related illness.
Yes.
So the denials had well and truly worn out by that stage.
But more recently, Scott Thorson, the writer of the book on which the film Behind the Candelabra was written, he's recently been sentenced to 8 to 20 years in a Nevada prison for failing another court-ordered drug test while on probation from burglary and identity. Now, how much did he get in that palimony? He got $113 million. My goodness, I wonder where all that money went. Well, apparently...
A lot of it seems to have gone into his bloodstream.
I reckon so. Well, he admitted that he was a drug addict, and but he was apparently determined at this court session when he was sentenced to 20, up to 8 to 20 years in jail. He was determined to get sober and tearfully appealed to the judge to spare him from prison. I'm just asking for another chance, apparently he said. But, you know, he said, I am in show business. I'm attracted to the cameras. I can't help myself. Well, that's not really a good enough excuse.
Yeah, well, and, he met Liberace when he was 18. So his life was somewhat interrupted and corrupted, I would quite well suggest.
Yeah, with money and everything like
that. Well, we can only imagine like what happened behind the scenes.
Oh, yes, behind the candelabra.
That's right.
But the judge at that particular court case says, I'm not impressed. I don't think anybody is with the so-called celebrity status. You're just like any other addict who has committed a crime against a victim. Well, Kardashians, take note.
They're a crime against nature.
They're famous for being famous. But there you are. No good came out of Thorson's book, even though he wrote it and there was a good seller and the film was a good moneymaker for the box office and everything. But he's been...
Well,
he's been trying to capitalise in on the fame ever since Liberace's death. He's not a celebrity, he's a story, someone said. It's one of accusation, manipulation, and failure. Oh, very sad times for Liberace. It's time for us to have a bit of a musical break. Let's see. And when we come back, we'll be talking about Cher, Miriam Margolyes, Ted Allen, and maybe a couple of other things in as well. You're on Joy 94.9. Phil and Chris, been there, done that.
Missed your favourite show? Head to the New Joy website and click on podcasts to catch up with the best Joy has to offer. joy.org.au.
You're listening to Been There, Done That, Joy 94.9. Phil and Chris, missing Gordon, but hello to Nina and to Cupcake. Hope you're enjoying the show. Hope things are going well for you. That was Sherilyn Sarkissian, Armenian-American. So that's why she's got her striking looks, because there's a little bit of Middle Eastern blood flowing around her veins, I would imagine.
Yeah, she was often thought to be American Indian.
Oh, yes.
I think it was more her
hype.
Her hype and her look and her makeup.
Yes, but, yeah. She was a marvelous person for costume and for hairstyles, often copied or aped by dragsters.
Well, an easy target.
Exactly.
And was an icon on Will and Grace.
Oh, yes, she was. Yes.
And an occasional guest star.
Yeah. And she had her own TV show with her husband at the time, Sonny and Cher.
Yep. Which was funny in and of itself, just seeing them on stage together, her towering above his tiny little body.
That's right.
But they'd often be carrying their little daughter, Chastity. And this is in the 70s, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
70s or 80s.
See, I never saw the show, I don't believe. So you're going to have to tell me.
It was just a cheesy American variety show.
Oh, right.
And they would tell viewing. Oh, yes. And they'd tell jokes. I should be using air quotes.
Yeah.
yeah, it was just cheesy. It must have been cheap because it was on for a while. Yeah, it was probably better than Dead Air. it wouldn't stand up in history.
What a recommendation that
is. Well, I was fairly young and probably hoping to get more out of television than that.
Yeah.
But her career took off actually after that show.
Oh, right. Okay, then, yeah. Well, she certainly kept the costumiers in business with all her fancy frocks and everything. Now, you were talking about Chastity, the baby.
The little girl.
Little girl. What happened?
They always had her looking so pretty and almost overly feminine.
Yeah.
And that might have had an effect on the poor girl.
Oh.
Because now she's Chaz.
Oh, right, yes.
Although I'm sure it's more to do with nature than nurture.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, sure. But it's age 17, Chastity, when does she have her sexual gender reassignment?
Oh, it's much later than that age.
Oh, yes, in 2010. So that's right. So there you are, that family, famous family. It's not as that famous family is famous for more than just Cher's singing abilities and costumery, but now for their child who's undergone gender reassignment and has come out.
It's
the
nice
transition
to see.
Was legally finalised in 2010.
It's nice to see that big stars, no matter what their background, are really just people.
Yeah,
and things that happen to normal people happen to the stars as well.
Mm.
And it would have been quite confronting, I would imagine, for Cher to deal with the transition.
Yeah.
And she's now really quite supportive. She's quite a star.
That's right. And the reason we're talking about Cher is because her birthday, she was born May the 20th, 1946. So she's...
Well, we shouldn't give the year, surely, for a lady.
Oh, she ain't no lady, as my mother would say. But there you are. Thank you very much, Cher.
Hello, this is Miriam Margulies, and you are listening to Joy 94.9.
Oh, what an expression that was. What a lovely voice. What a beautifully spoken message.
And what a nice lady.
Indeed, indeed. Miriam Margulies, having a birthday, 18th of May. She was born in 1941.
There you go again.
Wow. We won't mention her.
Well, you're not disclosing her age, but you're giving anyone with a calculator something to do.
Thank you indeed. Miriam Margulies, a character in such a small, power-packed little body. I don't know whether you've seen her recently in TV. She's been on a show recently called The Real Marigold Hotel, I think shown in here in Melbourne in the last fortnight, about a whole series of people who went to India to try and find a lifestyle that would suit their retirement years. And it was a real-life example of the film, The Marigold Hotel, that was a subject of parts one and part two on the cinema screen. However, we know her as Lady Whiteadder in Blackadder 2, and she was the Spanish Infanta in Blackadder with Rowan Atkinson. She's been in a couple of the Harry Potter movies. She's had her own stage shows where she's played many of Dickens' women. She knows Dickens' writings back to front, but she only ever says them the right way round. And she has had a stage show here in Australia where she would take on the roles of various of the Dickens' women. And she puts her all into those roles. Marvellous character actress.
An important role that most people may not be aware of, but should be aware of, was in 1988, Babe, Pig in the City. She played Fly, the female sheepdog.
Oh, right.
Or voiced the character.
She was in The Lavender Ladies with Margaret Smith and a couple of other people. Well, that's a nice little old DVD movie that pops up now and again. And she's been in lots of roles where it's just her voice coming out. And she's now, of course, not only was she was born in the UK, but she is now an Australian. She was at the 2013 National Flag Raising and Citizenship Ceremony in Canberra. She was actually given her citizenship certificate by Julia Gillard. I think they must have respected each other quite well there. She's a campaign for a respite care charity called Crossroads, and she referred to herself as a dyke live on national TV in Australia and in front of the Prime Minister then, Julia Gillard. So she's not backward in coming forward, and she has a partner of more than 40 years, Heather Sutherland, a retired Australian professor of Indonesian studies, and they formerly based in Amsterdam. And although she's Jewish by family birth, I don't think she particularly practices. She's not a practicing
Jew.
She's
a signatory to, if I can find it again.
There's a British-based organisation, human rights organisation, looking for human rights for the Palestinians. And that particular organisation seeks to end the Israeli occupation of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And she's also signatory for Jews for Justice for Palestinians. So that's the interesting bit, that there, as a Jewish person, she's actually not following the Israeli political line. Thank you, Miriam, for being also a friend of Joy. She's been here a couple of times. Bill, our previous host of the show, used to interview her on occasion, and Dean Beck has done an interview with her also on his program. Who else have we got? Ted Allen. Do you watch any of the cooking shows?
I watch some of them, but I remember Ted Allen from the Queer Eye for the Straight Guy series, which was quite brave.
It was quite brave, good word.
And actually showed how tolerant straight people can be, which is really quite amazing. I wonder how many states in America that would work in now, thinking North Carolina, for instance.
Ted Allen, born on the 20th of May, 1965. Who is he? He's on US TV, but he's also on Australian TV in one of the cooking shows. That isn't the whole extent of his notoriety.
He's sort of a lesser known gay man on our screens.
Yeah.
Because back in his original series, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, he was very much in the shadow of the main characters, because he was, I guess, the food specialist on the show.
Yes.
Where the fashion would have been the main topic.
Yeah, because they'd grabbed someone off the street who was a little bit scruffy and needed a bit of attention, and he'd be a straight guy always, but he would straighten him up and get him gayified and scrub him up nicely. And what was the food content of the show, I wonder?
I can't really recall.
No!
there must have been... what was each episode? Because it was formulaic.
Yes.
It must have been... it did end with the victim or the guest presenting a dinner party.
Oh, right.
For either one or more guests.
That's what it was,
with varying results.
So Ted Allen was the cooking expert. The food specialist. He's currently on Australian TV, on SBS, on their food channel, in a show called Chopped, where he's the host, and all these amateur cooks come up, and one by one they get chopped out of the series.
Well, that's how most series work these days, isn't it?
It is. Look, the clock's against us. Here we are. It's time for us to say cherry purrs. See you next week. Gordon will be back with a few wicked stories, maybe. I think he might be.
Well, if he's here, we'll let him talk.
All right.
If he's not,
you just try and stop him.
Oh, I wouldn't.
Thanks for being with us. Let's go out with Alex Newell and a great song called Basically Over You here on Joy 94.9. Stay tuned for some more encore shows here on Friday morning on Joy.
Friday night, if you blow my phone, talking about you all alone. What's that got to do with me? Since you broke me off, you ain't crossed my mind.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy 94.9. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.